the subcommittee. It is February 1, 2005, and we are gathered for the purpose of hearing House Bill 5044, the Department of Justice. And we're very pleased this afternoon to have with us the Honorable Hardy Myers, Oregon Attorney General, to provide an agency overview. Following that presentation, we will have a review of the General Counsel Division from Don Arnold. We will hear about the Civil Enforcement Division from Fred Boss and Cheryl Pellegrini. And then we will end with the presentation on the Criminal Division, and that presentation will be brought by Stephen Briggs. For the record, we are opening without a quorum, and I would note that Senator Winters will be absent, and she would like the committee to know that she participated in a drug raid in her district wee hours of this morning with, I believe she said, county or state officials, and she'll be updating us on what she learned the next time we see her. So with that said, welcome, Attorney General Myers. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you wish me to proceed now?
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I am Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm pleased to have this opportunity to open the subcommittee's consideration of the Department of Justice's 2005-2007 budget. The department's Phase 1 presentation to the subcommittee will concisely review the missions of the department and the quality or outcomes of its work as assessed by the department's performance measures. I'm going to present an initial overview of our work described by the program area and have a first review of the performance measures. We'll then review our work on a division-by-division basis, along with the measures that are specific to the particular divisions. And then I'll be concluding Phase 1 by a review of our prioritization of our missions for work. The Office of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice are creations of the legislature, not of the Oregon Constitution. And since the office and department were created in the late 19th century, the legislature over time has steadily added to the responsibilities it has assigned to the Attorney General and the department. Before a first review of our specific areas of public responsibility, let me take a moment to note how we describe the department's overall mission based on the different areas of public work that the legislature has assigned to the department. And it's fairly straightforward. The mission is to be the law center for state government and to carry out all other responsibilities assigned to the Attorney General and the department by the Legislative Assembly in the most effective way the department's human and financial resources will permit. And then the second paragraph really highlights, I think, a key judgment about the unifying purposes of the department's different missions. Although the assigned responsibilities differ from one another, they are united by a common goal to advance and uphold the rule of law in Oregon as applied to state government, individual citizens, and commerce. And I might say we could add to that and to contribute to the work of trying to hold lawbreakers, civil and criminal, justly accountable and to help to sustain and heal crime victims, victims of both criminal and civil wrongdoing. Let me take just a moment to overview the department's budget in the governor's recommended budget, just to give you a high-level look at the way in which the governor's recommended budget breaks out among the different divisions of the department. Child support, as you can see, is the dominant area budget-wise, with about 40-41% of the budget. Then the general counsel division, 14%, criminal justice, 18%, and then on around civil enforcement, trial, appellate, administration, the percentages you see there. And then we have one actual program on this slide, which is the defense of criminal convictions, which involves both the trial and the appellate divisions. We'll be talking about that more in just a moment. Also, here is the, from again a high-level view, here is the governor's recommended budget in terms of the different revenue sources to the department as between general funds, other funds, and federal funds. And you'll note that the department, relatively speaking, is a fairly small agency in terms of general funds, about 16% total. Other funds, which is dominantly fees received for legal services, 51%, and then federal funds, 32%. With these kind of overall budget details before you, let me begin to review the major responsibilities of the department by first noting the department's organization at its summit, if you will. The Attorney General and immediate staff are referred to in the department as the front office, and that office includes myself, the Deputy Attorney General, which is a statutory position, the Associate Attorney General. The deputy is really the first lieutenant for the law work of the department. The associate works primarily in terms of the administrative needs of the department. There are two special counsels who act to handle a variety of special assignments, the executive assistant, and then the policy program and legislative coordinator. This, again, is the overall leadership of the department. And then here we have the department broken down by its operating divisions under the front office, and those divisions are also shown over here in more detail, and we'll be reviewing that additionally as we go through each division's work. You can see, as an overall view, the governor's recommended budget proposes a 16.18 FTE position increase from the 2003-2005 legislatively approved budget. The governor's budget broken down by
Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Attorney General, thank you, Madam Chair. Are those few positions, are they mostly lawyers, sir, or administrative, or they're in child support, or where's the FTE increase?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, they are almost entirely in a single policy package in the General Counsel Division, which is intended to provide expanded legal representation to the Department of Human Services for child welfare proceedings. And there's a counterpart package in the Department of Human Services budget which links up with it. But those positions in this budget are dominantly lawyers.
Mr. Wilson, would you speak to that?
Just to clarify on that package, the general, they will bill Department of Human Services for those services, and therefore the general fund and the matching federal funds for those functions that can be matched are in the Department of Human Services budget, meaning that if that subcommittee and therefore in that agency do not approve that package, this really can't be approved either because it's a funding mechanism for it.
Madam Chair, how do we get together to be sure that does our co-chair work with their co-chair to be sure that they...
Well, staff, Madam Chair, and Representative Wisnett will make sure that will be coordinated, and you have at least two members of that subcommittee on this subcommittee also.
Thank you. Please continue.
The governor's recommended budget broken down as to the areas of program areas, as I'm going to be reviewing in a moment, you can see here, dominantly, first the child support program, about 40% of the budget, then the legal services to state government, 35%. So in just those two program areas, 75% of the Department of Justice's budget is accounted for in terms of funds. Then next we have what we call services to victims, 14%. Services to public safety, which are general funded, 7%. Services to public safety that are other or federal funds supported, 1%. programs to protect or enhance state resources, 2%. Self-funded regulatory programs, 1%. And I'm going to be reviewing each of these in just a moment now in more detail. But that gives you an overview. It also indicates pretty clearly how dominant those two particular programs areas bulk in the total budget of the department. First area I'd like to review is the area of our legal services to state government. The core mission of the Department of Justice is indeed to act as that law center. And in assigning that role, the department has adopted what is called the consolidated legal services model. By that model, all of the government's lawyers, except those who work for legislative counsel, and there are some lawyers in the judicial department, all other government lawyers are organized into the Department of Justice under the Attorney General. They are not employed by the individual agencies or departments that they may be advising and counseling. I think, quite frankly, the adoption of that particular model of legal services is one of the most important policy choices the legislature has ever made in terms of government structure. Because by that choice, the legislature has, I think, advanced multiple objectives, but I'll mention two or three that I think are paramount. One is the independence of the judgment of the attorneys who advise the government. By not having them working for the agency that they are advising and being instead accountable to the Attorney General, the legislature preserves by that model the kind of independence of judgment that I think is critical to the attorney-client relationship, public sector or private sector, quite frankly. It also gives us the ability to try to provide consistent legal advice on the same issue to different agencies by having a place where all of that work is pulled together and coordinated. It gives the ability to bring different specialties together when necessary to address legal problems, and it provides the ability to build over time a central pool of expertise across a wide variety of legal issues and practice areas. And it gives our lawyers the opportunity to create career paths within the department, because over time, individual lawyers in the department will move from practice area to practice area as they advance in their growth. The department has a lot of legal interaction with the Legislative Assembly, as well as with the Judicial Department. We do work for the Judicial Department in the sense of handling their employment law matters, for example, as a client department. But the dominant role of the Department of Justice is under the Consolidated Legal Services Model, ORS Chapter 180, is in relation to the executive branch. As to the executive branch, by ORS Chapter 180, the legislature has provided that the Attorney General is the exclusive, and the Department of Justice are the exclusive sources of legal advice to the executive branch, except to the extent that the Attorney General consents to the use of outside counsel by a particular agency or department. And by that, I think the judgment of the legislature that's reflected is dominantly the desire to have a single legal voice, not have differing views of the same legal issue emerging across the government by virtue of independent lawyers working separately from one another under no central point of accountability and control. Legal services for the state government and dominantly the executive branch are provided from several parts of the department. We'll be going over this in more detail in a moment, but if you will look over here at this larger chart for a moment, across the line divisions of the department, legal work is being done in the appellate, criminal justice, civil enforcement, general counsel, and trial divisions, all five of those divisions. And then in the front office, of course, the steering of the legal work of the department occurs here, front office level. So the work of this first program area cross-cuts a great deal of the department organizationally. Second area I want to note, services to children and families, the child support program, again, as noted, the largest of the program areas, and it includes the child support program director. That office and its responsibilities were transferred by the legislature last session from the Department of Human Services to the Department of Justice as the last step of a consolidation process that really began in 1997. And then the Division of Child Support itself, which is involved with the establishment of paternity, as well as the establishment, the modification, the enforcement of support orders, and the receiving, accounting for, and dispersing of all the millions of dollars of child support that flow under those orders. We also receipt and disperse the funds for the district attorney's caseload as well. About 200,000 cases in the Division of Child Support, about 50,000 cases in the district attorney offices. So 250,000 active child support cases in Oregon at this point. The next area I'd like to take...
Mr. Attorney General, before we move forward, as we go through the reductions, would you please talk about impact? What will you not be able to do if we take the level of reduction that is proposed?
Sure. If you want to backtrack for a moment to the legal services.
Madam Chair, when they're backpacking, the term LFO 10% reduction is, they're not our reductions in a sense, but as part of the process, we, with the co-chair's approval, have asked the agencies for 10% reduction from the governor's budget. So the term LFO is that we didn't, that they're not our reduction, but they wanted flexibility to the committee members to look at, because it's likely that you'll have to look at these agencies for reductions, at least initially during the session.
Okay. I appreciate that clarity. Representative Wisnot, and then Senator Devlin, you're fine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we talking general funds only here?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnot, those are all funds reductions, if I recall correctly, 10%.
Senator Devlin?
Sorry, I think the Representative Wisnot's question was, is this fund, is the principal source of funding general funds for this fund?
Oh, pardon me. Madam Chair, Representative Wisnot, no, this, the legal services to state government is financed by billings to agencies by the Department of Justice. So the money as it's received by the Department of Justice is other funds. I think the current analysis, however, of those dollars as they come from the government to the Department of Justice is about a third. If you look at the across the whole government, each dollar is about a third general fund,
40%. Roughly 40%.
And then the balance, other funds or federal funds, in the agencies that are paying the in the Department of Justice.
Madam Chair, follow up. Then I guess I'm still having trouble. Then I don't know how we can do this without the other services. Or if the Attorney General or Department of Justice cut these out, then the other services, they lose that money too, or that's because some of that's federal funded or state funded. I'm really having.
Mr. Wilson, would you please speak to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnot, one of the things that the subcommittee will do, and it probably won't be in the next few weeks, but relatively early in session as a work session item, is to approve the Attorney General rate, what they charge for services. And you'll walk through and how that's developed. In fact, I think as part of this presentation this week, you'll get a feel for it at least. And then the subcommittee will work session and come up with a final rate recommendation. And then that rate, staff, both BAM and ourselves, will go back and then make recommend adjustments in every agency's budget where the general fund, federal funds, and other funds are, and reduce what is essentially the Attorney General line in each of those budgets to sort of correspond with that rate.
Let me encourage you to keep asking questions, members. It just adds to all of our clarity. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That brings up then another question, and maybe you can help us with this. The 10% reduction that's listed as the LFO 10% reduction is from the governor's budget. And I'm sure we're going to get to more of this when we get a little closer to the budgeting process, so say so. But I think it's important that we not only see the essential funding level, or I think that's the new term, but for comparative purposes, the prior biennium funding as well. Because we talk about the essential level, but sometimes we're not always seeing where they were, and then we're taking this reduction from a completely different budget formula. It's hard to get to from where we were to where they'd like to be.
Yes. Very good point, Representative. Please continue.
I'm sure, Representative Hanna, the 10% reductions that are shown on these slides are not in the governor's recommended budget. I'll mention where there are recommended reductions in the governor's budget. There are three areas, but these are the reductions that are, if I believe they're mandated by a House bill.
No, they did. For the record, Kelly Friels with Budget Management. During the governor's process, agencies were required to give us 10% reductions. Some agencies, those 10% reduction plans will be the same ones that you see coming to committee. For this agency, that isn't correct. The governor actually took most of the 10% reduction, general fund reductions that this agency proposed, and that they came up with a governor's budget level at that point, and then the co-chairs asked the agency to come up with a further 10% reduction on top of that. So using the governor's budget as a base, the funding level you received in the governor's budget, the agencies were asked to then contribute or show a plan that would cut their budgets another 10%.
And that's the point that Mr. Wilson was making earlier that kind of got by us.
And it's not something LFO necessarily recommends. They
exactly.
haven't gone through the analysis to see if that's something they would recommend or not.
Madam Kosher, it's just plugging in the 10% reduction based on that House bill that said, hey, let's look at all of this with a 10% reduction.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, no, it's not a statutory requirement to do that. It was a co-chair direction that each agency come in with additional alternatives to reduce their budget. So you had other alternatives to look at to see if this is something you wanted to do or not.
All right.
And this might be a good time just to remind the committee. As homework tonight, we might all want to go back and just review the memorandum that we received from the co-chairs that laid out the process in phase one and phase two, and that talked about the level of cut that the co-chairs were asking the agencies to take. But the process is there, and we're just embarking upon it in real time. Representative Hansen?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Are you suggesting that the co-chair's recommendations don't have the force of law?
He's going to take the Fifth Amendment.
I'll assume that's a rhetorical.
Mr. Attorney General recalls that we said this was going to be a committee of hard work and humor, so we're just being consistent here.
That's a good mix, Madam Chair.
Please continue.
In any event, the 10% reductions that are being shown here are 10% reductions from the governor's recommended budget. Now, I apologize, the LFO designation is a little misleading, but I hope it's not an LFO, so we're talking about it now, at least not yet. So we'll resuming again the third area of program. Is the services to public safety that are general funded. This brings us to the this general fund and the child support program too, but this brings us to our first law enforcement public safety area that has general fund support. And this area includes this area is in the criminal over here in the criminal justice division of the department. With the district attorney and organized crime sections. First of all, those two lower bullets there, those are the two program areas you'll be hearing more about that are directed toward assisting district attorneys with the investigation and prosecution of crime. And then in the organized crime section, the work of both investigation and prosecution of official misconduct in Oregon. That section also includes the criminal intelligence unit, which is the intelligence center for law enforcement, state law enforcement, state and local law enforcement in Oregon. And then the other program that's supported by General Fund's public safety program is the Defense of Criminal Convictions, which, as I mentioned earlier, is split between the trial and the appellate divisions. When a criminal conviction is obtained in Oregon, the defense of that conviction, if it's appealed or if it's attacked by other avenues in state or federal court, the responsibility to defend that conviction falls to the Department of Justice. And because that work is not being done for a specific agency or department that can be billed for the work, the legislature funds it with general fund appropriation to the department. The next area would be services to victims. 14% of the governor's recommended budget. Two major components to this area. One is the various areas of responsibility in the Crime Victims Assistance section, including the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program, the CAMI program, which was shifted from DHS to the Department of Justice in 2001, and the Crime Victims Compensation and Assistance Program, and then the Domestic and Sexual Violence Grant Programs. The other component of what we're calling services to victims is in the Consumer Protection Program, because that is the principal civil law enforcement program in the Department of Justice, and we view it as a service to members of the public who have been victimized by civil wrongdoing.
I need to ask you to stop here again. Again, I have the same question that I have had on the other slides, and perhaps this information will come out later. Needing to understand the impact of any reductions that we talk about, especially in the area of services to victims. So as you talk about, as we're looking at what may end up being a reduction, please talk to us about what does that mean in terms of ability to provide services.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this particular area,
Representative Hanna also has a question.
Excuse me, just for a moment, because while I'm not a statistics major, and this goes to the Chair's question as well, I can't find a correlation between, and I know that the 10% reduction we just picked 10%, it seems to be an arbitrary number, but I don't see a correlation between the 10% dollar volume reduction and the FTE. Is there one, or is... I mean, otherwise, those are a couple of pretty high-paid folks.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, in this particular area, the 10% reduction is both a reduction in terms of funds available for, in this case, compensation, primarily compensation payments to victims,
okay,
and then there is a reduction of administration as well. To FTE.
Can I follow up on that? So, I mean, this would be an area that I would think, as we get to the budget presentations, we'll drill down and understand what part of that is compensation to victims and what part of it follows the FTE.
Exactly.
Madam
Chair. That's what I'm asking. Mr. Wilson and then Senator Dennis.
I think the Attorney General answered for what I wanted to bring out. So.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Attorney General, this might be an area to clarify something, too. That 10% reduction here, if my understanding is correct, the source of those funds for compensation are criminal fines and assessments?
In part.
Yes, in part.
Pardon me, Chair Gordley.
I'm not lobbying my position here, but I can say that there is a clear correlation between criminal fines and assessments and compensating victims. The governor has proposed that criminal fines and assessments be treated as general funds and then come back for these programs, and there are some of us believe that criminal fines and assessments should remain having a tie for the purpose for which they were created. That's just a advocacy statement.
I think it would be appropriate here to say that the governor proposes and the legislature
disposes. Yes.
Please continue.
Our next area would be services to public safety that are other funds and federal funds supported. This is 1% of the department's budget, and it's a variety of different programs that you'll be hearing a bit more in detail about in the divisional level that are, as I say, involve no general fund dollars, but form part of the total public safety effort of the Department of Justice. And here the 10% reduction is a 2-point FTE. And I have to be honest with you, Madam Chair, members, at this moment I'm not sure I can give you exactly an impact analysis around that item. We'd certainly be prepared ultimately to do that.
Madam Chair.
What?
Representative Wisnot.
Mr. Attorney General, thank you, ma'am. Is this where we would put our extra money for meth and to this? If we found some money for to attack the meth problem in the state, sir? Is this where we would put?
Chair Gregory, Representative Wisnot, if and to the extent the Department of Justice had positions added as part of that investment, they would be, and certainly would be, positions in the Criminal Justice Division's operations.
Yes.
And I suppose those might, could conceivably be in the form of either attorney positions, investigator, analyst. There are at least three possibilities, I suppose, that where the department might come into the picture.
Madam Chair, the governor's budget does include, I believe it's 9 positions in the state police for meth-related activities, which would be therefore detectives or law enforcement officials.
Madam Chair, follow up that comment. I read the governor's budget. Is he like asking for funding for a task force, including state police and more lawyers and investigators? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, at this time he's just added the 9 positions. 8 of them are in the criminal division of state police. 1 of them is the expected workload increase in the forensics lab.
Thank you.
As a result.
Please continue.
The other program, the next program area, is one we call programs to protect or enhance state resources. And these represent 2% of the department's budget. And they, this activity is centered primarily in 4 areas, about which you'll also be getting more detail later. 1, cooperative disability investigations focuses on fraud in the disability aspect of the Social Security program, which can have rippling effects into state program costs. The Medicaid Fraud Unit, which investigates and prosecutes both financial fraud in the Medicaid program, which is the state resources aspect of it, but it also has it also investigates and prosecutes the mistreatment of patients in Medicaid facilities.
Senator Devlin has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Attorney General, it may be very small now, but in all this explanation, and I know it's been reduced significantly, did the governor leave you anything in consumer protection, direct consumer protection?
Chair Gregory, Senator Devlin, the governor did not propose any general fund appropriation for consumer protection, and thus the program would be left, again, this biennium, to operate on the basis of the resources that come into what is called the Consumer Protection Education Revolving Account, which is, those are recoveries of the costs of enforcement obtained from wrongdoers. The legislature has provided that those are deposited into this fund, and the fund is continuously appropriated to the work of the Consumer Protection Program. So he is proposing that, yet again, for this coming biennium, that fund be the sole source of the financial support of the Consumer Protection Program.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Please continue.
Mr. Attorney General, in the last session, as you're well aware, we basically, I think, stripped that of almost all, if not all, general funds and funded it from that reserve. But we anticipated that the reserve, and we also cut positions, if my memory is correct, or we cut some resources, too.
my perception at that time was that this fund might not be adequate to continue the same level that we had last biennium and this biennium unless there was some infusion of general fund dollars. So will there be a further reduction in actual consumer protection activities by the office?
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, the presentation about that particular program area will be giving you some preview of how we envision the resources looking at the end of this coming biennium, absent some general fund restoration. We're giving you our best prediction of where we're going to be on that.
The reason I highlight that is because it's actually, in many cases, at least in my experience, has been another area of victimization, particularly with certain populations, seniors being one of them. So.
Please continue.
The final area of that program area I wanted to mention to note is what we're calling self-funded regulatory programs. 1% of the department's budget. And these programs involve the work assigned by the legislature to the department to the oversight of charitable corporations in Oregon, as well as oversight regulation of charitable gaming and charitable fundraising. And those program areas are all supported entirely by fees. The program performance measures, rather, which is the area I'd like to now turn to, if I may, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
There are two Oregon benchmarks that are pertinent to the Department of Justice's work. Benchmark 56, which measures the percentage of cases in which child support ordered in the case is paid in the month, in that month of the case. And the other benchmark relates to the overall number of reported crimes per, I believe it's 10,000 citizens in Oregon. The goals of the performance measures of the Department of Justice, somewhat summarized here, really focus on the efficient provision of the highest quality of legal services, client satisfaction, the enhancement of public safety, and the improvement of the effectiveness of efforts to increase support distributed to households with children. So touching on three different areas of the department's work.
The benchmark related to overall crime, just to correct what I thought I heard you say, it's overall reported crimes per 1,000 Oregonians.
Chair Gordley, thank you. I think I may have said 10,000. I meant to say 1,000. Thank you. Let me next note, if I may, the three performance measures that have a department-wide application. The first is the percentage of legal cases in which the state's position is upheld. The second, the percentage of litigation resolved through settlement. And then thirdly, the percentage of state agencies responding that rank the quality of legal services provided as good to excellent. The first of those, percentage of legal cases in which the state's position is upheld, the target is 92%, and we are just under that target for 2004, as you can see. 2004 is the first full year for which we have data, because these were measures approved in the last legislative session for this biennium. The second measure, percentage of litigation resolved through settlement. Let me explain to the subcommittee what's going on here. The original target we set for this area was 70%. And in doing so, we inadvertently included within the universe of cases that we were considering eligible for settlement all of the criminal appeals in the department, which aren't cases that we negotiate settlements for. So when we backed out the cases that don't really lend themselves to being settled, if you will, we came up with a target of 32% settlement. The remainder of the cases, the other 68%, are either resolved by summary termination, as with a motion to dismiss on behalf of the state. That accounts for the dominant percentage of the remaining cases, or a very small fraction, probably no more than 5% or so, are actually tried, ultimately tried. They're just not resolved. So with that adjustment in target, by virtue of the adjustment of the eligible caseload, so to speak, we're pretty close to target, as you can see, for 2004.
Senator Dudley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since this is supposed to be a pretty broad overview, I'm going to ask you the broadest of questions. When your department seeks settlement, and particularly in an issue of litigation, it seems to me that you're weighing the financial liability of the state in the situation, but you also have to weigh what is the right decision to make. How do you do that? I mean, in a sense, I know that decision probably has to be made at different levels in your department, but that's a significant issue. It's a significant issue, I think, in all public bodies, that when you think that you are right in the position that you are taking, even though it might expose you to some greater financial risk, sometimes the temptation is to settle.
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, the approach the Department of Justice takes to claims against the state is that if we believe that they are meritless, we do not settle them in order to make them go away. We think that is a mistaken tactic. And the vast majority of the claims filed against the state...
Which casualty companies did the same thing? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
The vast majority of the cases filed against the state are baseless claims, and most of them, a significant percentage, we are able to have terminated by summary disposition, by summary motions for summary disposition. On the other hand, if we believe that a case has merit, it is not our position to litigate the case to try to make the opponent capitulate just by the weight of the state's effort. We seek to resolve cases we think have merit. And if they aren't resolved, it's, I think, primarily because we simply can't reach agreement on what we believe is a reasonable sum to be paid given what we think is the loss involved.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I wanted to thank the Attorney General for that answer, because he also brought out a third element in that, which I think is one that I forgot to mention, and that is, given the state's, in terms of the state compared to an individual system, individual citizens, capabilities in terms of litigation, and some of the practices in other areas where people just maintain litigation to avoid settlement, actually. That was good to hear that the Attorney General add that into the equation.
Well, Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, and other members, I think the notion of a rule of law as applied to the state includes a recognition that if the state has violated its legal duties, if you will, and someone has been harmed in consequence of that, the state should pay.
Yes.
If we can arrive at what we think is a reasonable agreed amount.
Again, Madam Chair, thank the Attorney General for that statement.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
The final performance measure, department-wide, percentage of agencies responding that rank the quality of legal services provided as good to excellent. Target is 90%. Pleased to say the responses to date in 2004. In the survey that we just completed, I think at about 97%. Then the final thing I'd like to note by way of just quick preview, are those performance measures that are more program specific? There are certain ones that pertain to the child support program that you can see there, that you have among your, your slide material. The results of these measures will be discussed in the child support division's presentation. Similarly, we have other more program-specific measures, for example, amount of money recovered to the state divided by the cost of recovery. A very important one here also, average time from receipt of a contracting document to the first substantive response to the agency. It's a key marker in the timeliness and the efficiency of the department's legal services. These program-specific measures will be discussed in the divisional presentations. Madam Chair, members, that concludes my opening comments and overview for the subcommittee. I would just close by saying that, very sincerely, it's been a very, very great privilege to have the opportunity to be responsible for the missions of the Department of Justice. I think they're really a wonderful set of missions. I think the department feels pride in the fact that over the years the legislature has vested the department with these particular responsibilities. And if I could revert for just a moment to the mission statement, while, as I think you can see from the review, part of the work we do serves the government as a client, part of it serves professional law enforcement, part of it serves individual Oregonians, particularly child support, consumer protection areas. Nonetheless, as our mission statement indicated, we think all of those areas of work are united by a common purpose of trying to uphold the rule of law. That's our contribution to the quality of life in Oregon. And we look forward to working with you as you assess anew the work of the department in the life of Oregon, and we will do our very best, particularly in your new process, to try to provide you the information you expect and need to make your ultimate decisions about the department's budget. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. You're helping us get off to a good start. In my view, we appreciate your forthrightness, and I would just like to say again, or on the record, a little bit about a conversation we had just prior to the meeting beginning. It will be important for the committee to gain an understanding of what diversity looks like in the in your agency. The governor just last week, I believe it was, issued an executive order, which is a challenge to all of state government to live up to the words that also exist in statute, words that say that the state of Oregon shall be a leader in efforts around affirmative action and around contracting, making contracting opportunities available for minorities and women-owned businesses. And so at some point, we will need to hear, and again with respect to the organizational chart that you have presented to us, we will need to hear more about what the organization looks like in terms of its diversity today. What will be the challenges if reductions do take place? What will the organization look like as a result of any layoffs or downsizing? That type of thing. And I know that these are issues, but this is a overall issue that you care a lot about, and we'll look forward to hearing you speak more about it in the days to come, if not now.
Madam Chair, if it would be agreeable to you, as I think I may have mentioned in our conversation, if it would be agreeable to you, I would propose in my final presentation, which would be primarily about prioritization, mm-hmm. to open that presentation by coming back to this particular issue as it relates to the basic organization and working of the department.
That would be very good.
That would be satisfactory.
That would be very good. And thank you again very much for your hard work and dedication and commitment to all of Oregon. Calling up General Counsel Division presentation and Mr. Don Arnold. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Don Arnold. I am Chief Counsel of the General Counsel Division. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I have a lot to talk about, and I know I have very limited time, so bear with me. I'm going to try and breeze through this material pretty quickly. But I hope to be able to give you an overview of what the General Counsel Division is, what we do, what our assignments are, how we're organized, and I hope be able to respond to any questions you may have.
Would it be helpful to you continuing your train of thought if we held our questions?
Whatever you want to do, Madam Chair, I'll be prepared.
All right. Great.
The General Counsel Division is charged with providing the day-to-day legal advice and assistance that's required by state agencies. So our principal clients are the agencies in the executive branch of state government. And because we advise all of those agencies, we have a range of legal work that is very broad. We have organized the division into nine sections or attorney work groups, and those sections are organized generally along lines of groupings of agencies that have related missions. So, for example, we have a natural resources section, and that section is responsible for advising all of the state agencies that have a role in state natural resources issues. Similarly, our education section would be responsible for advising any agency with an education-related mission. Now, there are two exceptions to this general scheme of organization, and they are the business transaction section and the labor and employment section. And both of those groups of attorneys are responsible for advising all agencies in the areas of their responsibility. And that's simply because employment issues, for example, arise no matter what agency you're in. Now, this structure is intended to allow our attorneys to gain some specialization in the areas that they practice in, and it is also intended to increase the degree of consistency of our legal advice, because we have smaller groups of attorneys who are advising agencies that have related legal problems.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is contracting? Who's the expert for the state in contracting? Is that under administration or government services, or does that come under DAS? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, within the General Counsel Division, contracting is generally handled in the business transactions section. In the larger state government, Department of Administrative Services is responsible for a lot of the state's procurement.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
This chart shows the Department of Justice governor's recommended budget and the proportion of that budget that is devoted to the General Counsel Division. As you see, General Counsel's portion of that budget is about $38.5 million. That's about 14% of the overall department budget. And I would note that about 85% of the division's budget is devoted to personnel expenses. The general statutory tasks for the division are set out in ORS 180.060. This is a general statute that applies to the entire Department of Justice and sets out legislative assignments for the department, but the three provisions that I have noted here are portions of that statute that apply with special force to the General Counsel Division. And they they set out tasks for the division that include providing written legal opinions whenever we're requested by any state official, providing all of the legal services that may be requested by state agencies or officers, and assigning legal counsel, an individual attorney who's primarily responsible for the legal work of every state agency. Now, in practice, many agencies have many more than one attorney assigned to them. We have teams, for example, working with agencies such as Department of Administrative Services or Department of Transportation. But every agency has at least one attorney who's primarily responsible for ensuring that that agency's legal needs are met. The mission of the General Counsel Division is to deliver timely and cost-effective legal service that meets the needs of all state agencies. We provide service to over 100 different state agencies and commissions. Most of the work that we do is in direct response to requests for legal service from those agencies, although there are some statutorily assigned responsibilities I'll mention in a moment. As the Attorney General mentioned earlier, one of the primary goals of the department as a whole is to provide consistent legal advice to state agencies. And because much of that advice flows through the General Counsel Division, that is a primary goal of the division as well. Most of our work consists of oral and written legal advice that we provide to agencies. And again, as Attorney General Myers mentioned, there are other divisions in the department that are primarily responsible for litigation, but General Counsel also does some litigation. Usually, what we are involved with is litigation of a specialized nature. For example, General Counsel attorneys represent the Department of Revenue in the tax court. We appear for agencies in administrative hearings when agencies request us to do that. We represent the Department of Human Services in juvenile dependency cases. We appear on behalf of state agencies before the Land Use Board of Appeals and before the Employment Relations Board. We do a lot of work on legal document review and creation. A lot of that is contract-related work. And as I mentioned, we have some statutorily required functions. Those include developing model administrative rules for public contracting, model rules for contested case hearings and administrative hearings. We respond to petitions from the public for access to public records that are being held by state agencies. We approve agency requests for lay representatives who represent agencies in most contested case hearings. And finally, we're responsible for reviewing certain public contracts for legal consistency. We put a great deal of emphasis in the division on preventative training.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dollar amounts of contracts you review, or
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I don't have dollar amounts at my fingertips. I'll try and get that for you.
No, sir. Excuse me, Madam Chair. Follow up. No, are you,
so you mean what threshold?
Yeah. What's your rule for reviewing contracts? Is it?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, it varies by type of contract. In some areas, for example, some construction contracts, we don't review unless they're $3 million or above. Some other contracts, the threshold may be as low as $75,000. $75,000 is the minimum threshold. We don't review anything below that unless it's an exceptional case.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up. I have some contracting background. I don't understand. If you're protecting the state, it looks like you'd want to be looking at a lot more contracts to be sure the state's protected and in this contracting, because a contract is no better than the contract itself and the terms of that contract.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I completely agree with that. the legislature has directed the Attorney General to try and balance the legal risk to the state versus the cost to the state of conducting a legal review of the contract. So we have worked with agencies to try and identify types of contracts where there is small legal risk, identify types of contracts that haven't been challenged frequently in the past, and we've eliminated those from the requirement for legal sufficiency review. It's an ongoing process, and we try to work closely with the agencies. You know, frankly, many agencies don't want to send their contracts to us. I mean, they view that as an unnecessary expense to the agency. So we always have that, we have that back and forth pressure. I hope that responded. As I said, we put a great deal of emphasis on preventative law and training. We also have an active dispute resolution program in the division. The next slide deals with performance measures, and the Attorney General mentioned, I think, both of them that I'm going to comment on. One deals with our review time for contracts. This is a very sensitive issue, again, with agencies, because no matter how quickly you do them, I think they always think you could have done them more quickly. We have targeted 13 work days as our goal in this performance measure for the time period from when we first received the contract to response back to the agency. So far this biennium through the end of December 2004, our actual response time has been 5.6 days. During the last biennium, our actual response time was 6.6 days, so we have improved somewhat over the previous biennium. But that's something we are always looking to reduce response time on.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Clarification on the response time is that the response time before returning the contract and saying that everything is okay, or is the response time in terms of potentially indicating that more needs to be done?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, very good question. It's both. In about 65% of the cases, the first response is the final approval of the contract saying everything's fine and you can proceed with it. In the other 35% of the responses, we're either sending it back to the agency saying these portions need to be redone, you need a better statement of work to explain what the contractor is supposed to be doing, or we need additional information from the agency to allow us to complete our review.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam. When we have and this is more kind of generic outcome issue. When we see that we're exceeding our target by that much, does that automatically cause the target to be raised next year to 4.5 days, or at least consistent with 5.5? Or,
Madam Chair,
our target next year, not 13 days.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I'm not sure of the answer to that question. I know we have a process to work with the Progress Board, I believe it is, in setting these targets. I think this target should be lowered to be, you know, closer to what we're actually doing. But I'm not sure what the process is for that or when in the legislative or when during the biennium that process should occur.
I think there's a response.
Madam Chair, Kelly Frills with Budget Management. Had a conversation with agency heads, with co-chairs, and their explanation was that would be a phase two process where you would be evaluating the performance measures of the agencies and also setting targets for them.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, let's see, the next slide deals with a performance measure. This is a department-wide measure, but it's very relevant to the work of the General Counsel Division. The Attorney General mentioned it earlier. This is based on the client services survey that we just completed in December of 2004. This is an overall question asking agencies to tell us how overall they view the quality of our work. And as you can see, the results of the response to that question, I think, were very positive. Let me say a little bit about this survey. This is something we do every year. We send it out to all state agencies. We try to put a survey in the hands of everyone in state agency land who deals with the Department of Justice. So the survey goes to agency heads, to board and commission members, to board and commission executive directors, to contract officers and human resource staff in agencies, to agency program and division managers. As I say, just about anyone we think has any connection with the Department of Justice. And this last year, in December, we sent out 507 surveys. As of January 21st of this year, we received back 293 surveys, responses to the survey. So I think that's a fairly high response rate. And this slide and the next slide are going to give you some more information about results from that survey. The complete survey, all of the questions and the responses to those questions are included in the Phase 2 materials of your packet if you want to look at it in more detail. The next slide, this slide deals with timeliness of legal services in a variety of categories. And as I've said, in connection with contracts, timeliness of service is very important to the agencies that we work with. So we have asked them to respond to these questions, and this chart details the percentage of respondents that were saying they agree or strongly agree with the statement that the following services were provided in a timely manner. And again, I think the survey results are pretty good for each of those categories. This next slide, I'm not going to spend much time on. What I wanted to do here was simply give you a flavor of some of the work that's currently underway in the division. I selected these items because all of them are consuming a lot of legal resources right now. And all of them are long-term projects. I think almost all of them, maybe all of them, started last biennium. We will be working on them throughout this biennium on into next biennium. And some of them, such as the Klamath Water adjudication, are going to continue for years on into the future.
I would think that the child welfare dependency caseload would increase given the meth explosion. Is there a relationship there?
Madam Chair, I think that the dependency caseload is increasing at a fairly rapid rate. And I understand that Ramona Foley from DHS testified at, I'm not sure it was this subcommittee, but at one of the subcommittees in the last few weeks, about the impact of the meth problem on juvenile dependency and child welfare. And it is having a substantial impact.
So the question there to be answered later in more detail would be, do you have the capacity required to meet the caseload demand?
Madam Chair, we have nowhere near the capacity to meet the caseload demand. The policy package that the Attorney General mentioned earlier is a general counsel policy package, and it is intended to take a step toward meeting this caseload demand. And I'll talk a little bit about that later as I get to that package.
Very good. Thank you.
This chart is a representation of one measurement of workload in the division over the last 10 years. This measurement looks at number of files, new files opened on a calendar year basis. And as you can see, over the last 4 or 5 years, workload has been very stable. We are projecting that that is going to continue in the next biennium, at least absent unanticipated events. I mentioned earlier that we put a great deal of emphasis on preventative law and training and on appropriate dispute resolution. This slide goes in a little more detail on some of those issues. During the course of a typical year, we present between 100 and 150 different training sessions for state agencies. And those training programs cover a wide variety of topics. Some of them are very targeted. They may be targeted to a specific agency or even to a specific program within an agency. And some are very broad-based and may be targeted at all agencies in a particular area. For example, last year, in 2004, we did a series of trainings for Department of Revenue appraisers to help them write appraisal reports that were more clear, more concise, and that would be more easily understood when they were used in the tax court. We also worked in collaboration with the Department of Administrative Services and presented a multi-day series of trainings for all state agency human resources staff that covered a wide range of employment topics. We do prepare a number of different publications for use by state agencies. I brought for show and tell a couple of them. This is the Attorney General's Public Contracts Manual, and this is the Administrative Procedures Manual. We review and update all of these manuals following each legislative session. We also prepare a manual on public meetings and records law. Some of these things, because they apply to general statutes that apply to all levels of government, are used not only by state agencies, but also by local government. We have an active dispute resolution program. We have a staff person who's dedicated to ADR activities. Among his tasks is to provide training in ADR not only for general counsel attorneys, but for attorneys throughout the department. He also works with state agencies in providing training to them, support to the ADR staff that may be located in some of those agencies. We maintain a computerized roster that is available to state agencies, listing mediators who are interested and willing to work with state agencies. And we've developed, along with the Department of Administrative Services, an expedited contracting process so that agencies can quickly hire mediators off of this roster. We have an internal policy on contract review, and we've adopted administrative rules dealing with our contract review process. And this had two primary purposes. We wanted to clearly establish, both for our agents, for our attorneys, and for the agencies that send us contracts, exactly what it is that we're looking at when we review a contract for legal sufficiency. We also wanted to make it clear that the agencies remain responsible for the business decisions that are associated with those contracts, including making assessments about how much business risk the agency thinks is appropriate to assume under the contract. The final thing I wanted to mention on this chart is the creation of a legal advice database. This is something that we began work on last year. We currently have over 1,000 documents in this database, and those documents consist of written legal advice that we have sent agencies, But I think importantly, we have also begun including in the database advice that we provide to agencies by email. And that had been very problematic in the past because emails tend to disappear. You know, they get deleted at both ends by the sender and the receiver. They sometimes don't get into files, and they certainly weren't in any kind of database that was searchable and retrievable. So we have started putting those in this database as well. This assists us in both assuring that our advice is consistent over time and between agencies, and it also is a cost-saving measure for agencies because we have captured all of that research that we've done in the past. We don't have to redo it when a similar question arises in the future. This chart, Madam Chair.
Sorry for the interruption, but going back to the matters opened by year chart,
yes.
We see a jump from 96 to 98 of 4,000. Was there something structural there that happened, or is that a...
What's that?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, there was something specific that caused that. It was new legislation that required for the first time that agencies have contracts reviewed for legal sufficiency. So we began, that's the result of the cause of the jump. This slide deals with the 10% reduction in the General Counsel Division budget. As you can see, it amounts to about $3.8 million. I mentioned previously that our budget is about 85% personnel costs, so a reduction of this magnitude is going to necessarily result in a significant cut in staff in the division. It would eliminate about 59,000 to 62,000 hours of attorney service time on an annual basis. And in terms of consequences, that would certainly mean timeliness would suffer, timeliness in responding to requests for legal service. We simply wouldn't get to some request. We wouldn't have the staff to handle it. And if those things were going to be responded to, we would have to send them to outside counsel, and that would be at a significantly higher expense to the state. Policy package 451 is the only policy package in the governor's recommended budget for the General Counsel Division. This is the policy package that the Attorney General referred to that has a corresponding package in the Department of Human Services governor's recommended budget. And, Madam Chair, this is the package that addresses the issue that you mentioned dealing with child dependency caseload. The problem in a nutshell is we simply don't have the staff and DHS doesn't have the resources to adequately meet the needs for DHS caseworkers in this area. And just to give you an illustration of the problem, in 2004, DHS appeared in about 21,000 hearings, circuit court hearings, involving juvenile dependency cases. And juvenile dependency, as you know, are cases that involve child abuse and neglect and abandonment. So these are serious matters. These are the cases that you've read about in the paper recently involving serious injuries to children or death to children. The Department of Justice is representing DHS in about 5% of that 21,000 hearings. That means most of the time DHS caseworkers are appearing in these hearings in circuit court without legal representation, and DHS's position on behalf of arguments on behalf of the best interest of the child in those cases is being presented without benefit of legal counsel. That's a serious handicap to DHS because their caseworkers are not lawyers. They can't practice law. They can't file motions in court. They can't call witnesses. They can't cross-examine witnesses. So DHS is at a serious handicap there. This policy package that we're...
This policy package that
we're presenting would be a step toward addressing that problem. It would allow us to increase the number of cases we appear in from about 5% to about 15%. And that's still not a lot of cases, but it is a big step in letting us appear in at least the most, the most contentious, the most serious of those cases. The other benefit of this package would be to give DHS caseworkers more access to legal advice. As things stand now, legal resources are so stretched in this area that virtually all of the attorney time available goes to appearing in the few cases that we appear in. But the package would increase the number of attorneys available in this area so that caseworkers would have some more access to legal assistance.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to actually add a question concerning this and also a question concerning the previous slide in terms of reductions. The previous slide in terms of reductions, talking about 18 to 19 attorney positions and 6 to 7 support staff positions. In the governor's recommended budget, you have an increase actually in 19 positions and 14.5 FTE. So if you took that 10%, you would have a net reduction from your 03, 05 levels, is my take on it.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I believe that's correct.
Okay. And the other thing, I don't believe there is, but this work in terms of child protection, would this be all general fund, or would there be any other source of funds for it?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, it would be a combination of general fund and federal fund.
Okay. So there are federal funds available. Thank you.
I have a question about the third bullet on the reductions, if you can go back. The response times reduced, some requests for legal services unmet. You talked about the possibility of having to use outside counsel. Is there a precedent for that? Who would you contract with? And how much an increased cost are we talking about?
Madam Chair, there is a precedent for it. We do currently contract with outside counsel from time to time. Sometimes it's in a case where we simply don't have the staff available to meet the needs of the agency in the time that they need the work done. Most recently, we have done that with labor and employment issues. Going back to the workload chart, during that period when cases were really ramping up because of the additional contract work, we did not have nearly enough transactions lawyers on staff to handle that work. So we sent a lot of contract work to outside counsel, and I can probably get you the figures on it, but it seems to me it was like $4 million in outside counsel cost just for that contract work over the course of biennium. The legislature did give us some additional staff and direction to bring that work back in-house, which we were able to do over the course of a biennium, and there was a very substantial savings in the difference between what it cost us to do the work and what it cost private law firms to do it.
If you would please bring back some more detail on the questions I raised. that would be very helpful to our understanding.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that concludes my presentation unless you have additional questions.
Mr. Arnold, thank you very much. Appreciate your work. Civil Enforcement Division, calling up Mr. Fred Boss and Ms. Cheryl Pellegrini. Good afternoon, and please go forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm the Assistant Attorney General and Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. Today, I'd like to provide you an overview of the Civil Enforcement Division. The division is composed of five sections arranged in practice groups. It is the second largest division in the department with 130 positions. The budget for the governor's recommended budget for the Civil Enforcement Division is $26.94 million, representing approximately 9% of the total budget for the department. The Civil Enforcement Division is primarily a civil plaintiff trial division. It sues to obtain money or to enforce the law in the civil court. There is one minor component that does do some bit of criminal matters in the Medicaid fraud section, and I'll talk about that in just a little bit. I'd like first to turn to the civil recovery section of the division. The civil recovery section is that section that does sue for money that is owed to state agencies. Another very important task of the civil recovery section is to enforce the non-participating manufacturer clause, which ensures the flow of money from the large tobacco companies under the Master Settlement Agreement. And that flow of revenue is between $60 to $80 million a year. We stress efficiencies in this section, pushing the work down to the lowest billable unit. An example of the litigation that the unit or the section does is the New Carissa litigation. If you would recall that the motor vessel New Carissa went up ashore in the Coos Bay area, spilled a lot of oil, and the wreck remained on the beach. This section sued the owners and operators of that boat and obtained a judgment for monies in order to remove the wreck. And that judgment is presently on appeal. The section averages recovering between $20 to $25 million per biennium into the state. And this is actual dollars into the state, not merely judgments or something like that. Here we have several factors that do affect the services for this section. Bad economic times, unfortunately, drive up the workload here because people are defaulting on their obligations to the state. And this is the unit that does sue for breach of contract and for enforcing the obligations that people have to the state. Another factor is, as I addressed previously, the enforcing of the tobacco and rules or the tobacco laws in order to ensure the flow of revenue from the Master Settlement Agreement. like now to turn to the charitable activities section.
Madam Chair, do we have a
representative Wisnant?
A brief moment. I'm not familiar with what you're talking about, the non-participating manufacturers. I don't know that I need to know, but is there a couple of sentences you can tell me what we're... I know the big companies, but what could you give me a couple of sentences about that, please, sir?
Chair Gordley, Representative Woodson. As a part of the master settlement agreements with the large tobacco companies, the states agreed to enact laws that would cover those companies that are not signatures to the master settlement agreement, and to make sure that there was a level competitive playing field. What the states and the tobacco companies agreed to was that those tobacco companies that did not sign on to the master settlement agreement and then give money to the states would have to take the same amount of money that they would have paid to the states and set it aside in an escrow agreement. So what we do now is we have to gather information on what companies are selling tobacco products in the state that are not signatures to the master settlement agreement. Then we have to, we ensure that they have set up a proper escrow agreement and that they have put the proper amount of money into that escrow agreement. That ensures that they don't have a competitive advantage over the other tobacco companies who have signed on to a master settlement agreement. It also provides potentially funds that if we were to sue those companies for the same type of causes of action that we had against the other tobacco companies, that we would be able to recover some monies.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry.
Oh, no apology necessary. Please continue.
Thank you. The charitable activities section has a basic goal of allowing Oregon to be a safe place to give to charities. There are two programs in this section. One, the regulation of charitable gaming. The other, the regulation of the charitable organizations themselves. For both of those programs, they have a registration and a licensing function. They provide an enforcement. They enforce the laws involving both charitable gaming and charitable organizations. But I'd like to point out that they also serve a very valuable education resource, both to the charitable organizations themselves, who can call up and seek information on how they should organize their charities or the proper rules for conducting gaming, for example. In addition, this section provides a very important public educational resource. It maintains the records of the charitable organizations for the public to come and review. In addition, there is a website so that potential donors can check on charitable organizations, find out what percentage of the donation does go to actual charitable activities. As Attorney General Myers pointed out, there are no general funds that finances this section. Is completely fee supported. The charitable gaming workload has decreased through the years, and this is the regulation of games and solicitations, but primarily games that are put on by charitable organizations. With the competition from the lottery and with the tribal casinos, this charitable gaming has decreased. Conversely, the regulation of charitable organizations has increased, primarily due to the popularity of vehicles such as charitable foundations as a method of giving. I'd like next to address the family law section.
Please.
family law section has two clients. The first is the Department of Human Services, in which they conduct the termination of parental rights. And the next is our very own Division of Child Support, in which they conduct litigation concerning support orders. As we can see, unfortunately, the termination of parental rights caseload is increasing, primarily fueled by the methamphetamine crisis. This is also fueled by very tight federal deadlines, so that a case has to be initiated within a short period of time, and once filed, has to be tried within a short period of time.
Senator Devlin.
I'm sure many of the members of the committee realize this already, but with that increase, you're providing legal counsel to the Department of Human Services. Indigent Defense is providing legal counsel, in many cases, both to the child and to the parents whose rights are being terminated.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's my understanding.
Representative Hansen.
How does this activity differ from the policy package that we reviewed in the last?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, it is a different segment of the timeline than when a family is in trouble and needs services from the state. Then the General Counsel Division, in coordination with the Department of Human Services, handles that portion of it, going to court and trying to have a plan for the family. When it reaches the point in time when it's decided that in the best interest of the child, the parental rights have to be terminated, then it is shifted to the family law section. So as we go along, say, with a family in difficulty, as they go through the various stages, this is the very last stage in which the parental rights are terminated.
Please continue.
Thank you. With the Division of Child Support, our work is primarily with the support orders, and the workload there is increasing primarily because of the emphasis on collections and on contempts in as a method of collecting child support. The work in establishing paternity, conversely, is going down because of the almost certainty of DNA testing that we don't litigate these cases anymore. And as I stated, here are some of the reasons that our workload is going up, and it is focusing on collections, contempts, and then the very tight federal guidelines that the termination of parental rights cases operate under. If I can now turn to the Medicaid fraud section. The Medicaid Fraud Unit is a federally mandated unit. It prosecutes fraud in the Medicaid billing and also prosecutes the abuse of patients in nursing homes. Through the years, this unit is handling more cases. It obtains monetary recoveries. And these monetary recoveries, both from their civil lawsuits and from restitution in criminal judgments, go to the federal government and to the Oregon Health Plan. It's important to recognize that in the Medicaid fraud section, that the funding is a 3-to-1 federal match. So for every state dollar, the federal government puts up $3. The Medicaid fraud section has actually been affected by its own success because it has been very successful in the prosecution and in obtaining civil judgments. There have been an increase in referrals both from the federal government and from local law enforcement. Uh, I would like to now turn the microphone to Cheryl Pellegrini, who is the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, and I'm going to talk about financial fraud consumer protection. This is the only agency in state government that is specifically charged with protecting consumers in the marketplace. Our mission is to enforce the laws so that Oregonians can make informed choices and purchase goods and services with confidence, and also so that businesses can aggressively compete in an environment where all operate according to the same ground rules. We have traditionally accomplished our mission in the first instance by focusing on education and outreach. And we have reserved enforcement for those cases where our words of warning have fallen on deaf ears. Until 2003, the legislature has recognized the importance of our work through the allocation of general funding. This allocation has historically assisted us in absorbing the costs of education and outreach, and has continued to allow us to take on cases knowing that cost recovery is unlikely, but where we are the only agency with the legal means to act to protect the public by stopping an unlawful practice and by seeking compensation for those harmed. Now, in addition to legal staff within my section or within this program, we also have people who are dedicated to helping individual citizens. And those people are the positions that are over on the left-hand side of the organizational chart, the Consumer Information Coordinator, that's Jan Margosian, our volunteers and their coordinator and enforcement officer. And I would note that it is this area that was cut in 2003 by the elimination of an enforcement officer position, and then there was also an investigator and a support staff position that were eliminated. Jan is the cornerstone of our educational and outreach efforts. I think all of you are probably familiar with her and her work. She coordinates with other agencies such as the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Construction Contractors Board, and the services to seniors and people with disabilities to pool resources and to plan and produce educational brochures and to put on programs that target vulnerable populations. We also have pooled our resources and sponsored a state fair booth every year, actually until last year. In addition, in years past, Jan has made as many as 200 appearances before groups around the state. As well, she often assists legislators, their staff, and other agencies who refer constituents with particular consumer problems. In addition, we've developed a consumer protection page on the Department of Justice website. We update it often, and it offers a lot of good and current information about new scams, recent court actions, and links to other agencies that are of help to consumers. The point here in all of this is to get consumers and businesses to recognize, avoid, and report marketplace misconduct. Now, we've always provided services to individual consumers. We do this in three ways. Since 1996, under Attorney General Meyer's administration, we have staffed a hotline. It's toll-free, and it's open from 8:30 to 4:30. It is staffed fully by volunteers. We have had as many as 50 volunteers working 90 shifts a week. The day is broken out into three shifts a day. We now, as you can see, are down to about 24 volunteers. In addition, people call the hotline for information about a particular business or to access, say, pre-recorded messages about various consumer protection topics. Now, in addition, consumers also write to us, mail, online, referral from other agencies, to report a particular practice. Our intake unit, which is comprised of an enforcement officer and an investigator, looks at each and every piece of mail that we receive. And their first task is to make sure that the person's complaint is with the right agency. Our enforcement officers work with consumers and businesses. They review written complaints that come through our office that are within our jurisdiction. They work with businesses and consumers. They attempt to resolve individual complaints informally, and they're also looking for evidence of larger patterns or practices that may violate the law. Each year, in fact, next week, we'll release our top 10 list of consumer complaints for 2004. These are the types of complaints that the enforcement officers tend to see, and they direct the sort of assistance that the officers provide to the public. The complaints vary from year to year. For the past several years, I can tell you that telecommunications and financial services have been in the forefront of the minds of consumers, and they comprise by far and away the largest volume of particular complaints that we handle.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin.
I do note one that I think I've seen once before, but it's interesting that it's on here at this level. It looks relatively low, but Nigerian money transfers. And while I think people in this building might think that most people would not be duped by those, you actually do have cases of people transferring money.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that is correct. In fact, there was a professional in Portland who lost over $100,000.
No way.
So they do present. And this particular scheme, it evolves or devolves according to what crisis happens to be in the world's eye at the moment.
Madam Chair, but I think it's an example of one of those things where I think the average person doesn't think that most consumers are pretty active, pretty discerning consumers. But others, I mean, there are plenty cases of people coming around saying that they will do home remodeling, tearing down a wall, taking half the payment and never coming back. So...
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that is correct.
Please continue.
Thank you. We draw enforcement cases from a number of sources. We do cases in conjunction with other states. These cases tend to target practices that affect consumers nationwide. A couple of good examples are we are still involved with the Attorneys General of California and Washington in an electricity pricing and supply investigation occasioned by the collapse of the electricity market in California after the 2000-2001 price spikes, and we're still looking at those power producers and their role in the market. There are also cases that we receive on referral from other agencies where we partner with other agencies to target businesses or individuals whose conduct falls beyond the reach of an agency's administrative authority. Or, in some cases, we accept referrals from criminal law enforcement because we happen to be better positioned in certain circumstances to stop conduct and achieve compensation for consumers than criminal law enforcement authorities are. We also take some cases based on complaints that we receive from consumers, like those that find their way to the top 10 list. The majority of cases that the majority of our enforcement cases settle short of litigation, and there is a specific remedy within the Unlawful Trade Practices Act that allows us to offer to a business the opportunity to enter into an assurance of voluntary compliance. It is a court-ordered agreement, like a consent decree. It does not require a finding of liability. It often requires a business to pay restitution to consumers. It shifts the costs of our enforcement onto them, and it also requires them to change their business practice in order to avoid falling afoul of the law in the future. These program statistics reflect early effects of suspension of general funding for the program by the 2003 Legislative Assembly. You can see that both calls to the hotline and written complaints are down. As we read these numbers, we believe that this is due directly to the reduction that we've had to make in education and outreach, to the extent that we are not out there telling people what to look for and reminding them to call us, they don't. This chart sets out or illustrates where the funding for the program comes from and what our expenditures have been. The amount that we receive from our case settlements varies significantly from one biennium to the next and does not provide a steady stream of income. Traditionally, the general funding allocation by the legislature has smoothed out the income stream and ensured that there's a steady influx to fund all of our program activities. Without general funding, there's a serious concern that this program will not survive. In addition, continued lack of general funding threatens our ability to take on cases without regard to the likelihood of cost recovery. More Oregonians will fall victim to fraud. The less we're out there in the public eye, the more vulnerable our citizens will become, and we're seeing it already. Finally, we're the only program dedicated to consumer protection. If we go away, no one will step in to do our job.
Madam Chair, these are performance measures that are...
Representative Hansen.
Before we move forward, any discussions in terms of a stable funding source for consumer protection beyond the general fund? And I'm thinking in terms of like a surcharge on business license fees or...
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I can tell you that I believe in the mid-90s there was some internal discussion within the Department of Justice about whether or not to seek an addition to the fees paid by businesses to the Department of Corporations within the Secretary of State, in part to create funding for the program, but I'm not sure. I don't know whatever came of that. I just recall that there were discussions.
The other question would be, within, when we look at the number of complaints that we get out of the telecommunications area, if possibly some type of shared revenue with the Public Utilities Commission.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, what we've done with the Public Utilities Commission is we are actually engaged now in a cooperative effort whereby we're taking all of the complaints, slamming and cramming of unauthorized charges, and we're sending those over to the PUC, and they have set up, as a result of legislation last year, they now have the authority to informally resolve slamming complaints, and they're also working on cramming. In addition to that, we have just asked for their help. We have assurances with three large wireless carriers, Sprint, Verizon, and Singular, and we have engaged the services of the PUC staff to assist us in handling individual consumer complaints that come in against those three companies so that we can monitor those companies' compliance with the assurance. So we really are partnering with agencies to best use limited state resources.
these two performance measures are actually, they're applicable to this division, yet I believe they are reported on a department-wide basis.
We have just a time check. We've got about 5 minutes left. If you could wrap up the presentation in that time, that would be very helpful.
I would be pleased to do so. This is a performance measure. Performance measure 137-3 is one that is applicable to the civil recovery section. It measures the cost of recovering money for the state. The state recovered $6.77 for every $1 that it spent. Or it cost 15 cents to recover $1, however you want to do the math. Traditionally, this unit does operate more on an 8-to-1 level, and this, I believe, represents kind of a dip that is due primarily to the efforts put into the new CERISA litigation. We did obtain a $25 million judgment there that is presently on appeal. Those funds are not reflected here because it's on appeal. And so I think this would, if I come back to you in 2 years, then we will be at back more at the 8-to-1 level. Performance measure 137-6 is something that is applicable, a performance measure that is applicable to the charitable activities section, and it hopefully gauges the effect of the educational program of the of that particular section. It has fallen short of its goal. However, in talking to the attorney in charge of that section, this goal was set up with a combination of several of factors involved, and not just this one measure, and we will be seeking to have it adjusted. As I stated at the outset, the Civil Enforcement Division does stress efficiencies and pushing the cases down to from the higher charging and billing attorneys down to a level of support staff, paralegals, and law clerks. And here are some of the methods that we use. Finally, my final slide is the House Bill 3182 reductions. The reductions would be of about $2.7 million. There is a reduction in federal funds that is from the 3-to-1 match that the Medicaid Fraud Unit has. That concludes our presentation on the Civil Enforcement Division.
Thank you, Mr. Boss and Ms. Pellegrino. We appreciate your work and preparation for this hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Members, before we adjourn, is there anything for the good of the order? And Representative Wisner, did you want to address the draft?
No, ma'am. It's an update a little bit from when I gave you the one pager before. I've talked to Mr. Murphy from the old Office of Emergency Management, who will now be working in the Oregon Office of Homeland Security, and he gave me some updated information. So it's your pleasure. I'd be happy to share that with the other committee members.
Please. I would appreciate it. And again, very appreciative of your efforts and leadership, Representative Wisner, as we prepare for a later presentation from the Oregon Homeland Security Department, and appreciate your willingness to take on helping us lead that discussion.
And Mr. Murphy has offered, Madam Chair, to work with me and be sure I'm up to speed so I can help the committee members understand and go through that item quickly. It's a lot of money, a lot of federal money, especially.
Absolutely. Mr. Wilson, anything for the good of the order?
Madam Chair, a matter of rules. When we open our subcommittee with without sufficient numbers for a quorum from the Senate side, does it take two senators? And this is just a matter of rules, but when we open without them and then they come in, do we need to close and reopen the hearing with the appropriate folks? Just a matter of...
Technically, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
I noticed them doing that in other meetings is why I'm asking, but I'm just not sure how that works.
That's a good catch on your part, and thank you.
During work session, it'll be very important because we'll need two from each side for sure that to take action.
Okay.
Thank you all, and we will see you on tomorrow where we will take up the criminal division and hear from Stephen Briggs. Thank you, and we're adjourned.
What, which is the next one?